Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome back. Last week, we talked about kashas in the workplace. We discussed a few things, two kulas and one chumra. We'll start with the kulas. First of all, when you have a microwave at work, it's a treif microwave, it's basar, it's chalav, it's everything. The easiest thing is don't worry about kashering it, don't worry about cleaning it. Just put your food in, put a plate down, a cardboard, you know, something thick that won't let moisture, you know, seep through, like plastic or the plastic-covered cardboard or styrofoam, and then double-wrap your food. Double-wrap does not mean that it's sealed. It just means that it's two wrappings to prevent condensation from falling on that food. And then throw away the outside wrapper, and the inside wrapper will still be kosher, and that will prevent the condensation that has formed from the zeya, which is the pillar of steam that we said absorbed into the roof and might drop down droplets that absorb the tarfas from before. So if you have a cover, you'll be protected from that. That was kula number one. Kula number two is, after all is said and done, we came out that fruit salads are usually okay, can be assumed to be okay in a not kosher restaurant. And that's because, A, we hope that they have clean knives. And even if they don't have clean knives, we saw with the discussion of limonish, lemonade, old-time lemonade, is the Gemara talks about the Rishonim speak about cutting, slicing lemons, and even if the first few lemons were cut with a knife that's dirty, we're not worried about the rest of the lemons that are cut because the dirt on the knife gets wiped off with the first cuts. And then those first few of slices that are usser will now be batel barov in the majority of the slices that are mutter. So let's say I take my dirty knife and I cut 10 slices of cantaloupe. The first 3-4 slices are in fact usser, because they have residue from those dirty knives. Let's say they were dirty. I'm not worried because those 4 dirty slices that are not kosher slices of cantaloupe become batel barov to the 6 slices of cantaloupe that are kosher. So if you only have 2 slices of cantaloupe or 3 slices of cantaloupe, that's going to be a problem, because they won't be batel. The ones that might be dirty won't be batel, the ones that are hopefully clean. But if there are a bunch of slices and the knife had to slice a bunch of times, such that even you could have a few knock out whatever residue is left on the knife and a few others to overweigh those usser ones, to outnumber those usser ones, then we could be makel and allow salads, fruit salads. The chumrah that we said, and this is a chumrah that I want to I have to do some more research on. We talked about spouts, which I'm sure wreaked havoc on your weeks. I apologize for that, on your week. We said that spouts from a hot water urn used with non-kosher, where non-kosher soups and hot cocoa splatter up, or even if they don't splatter up, the zeya, the heat from the cups rise up. Somebody pointed out to me that, I don't remember if it was in the shiur later, that the cup that you're holding is a kli sheni, right? You have the hot water coming out of the urn, that's the kli rishon. It goes into the kli sheni, which is your cup. So theoretically, steam that's going up from your cup is steam from a kli sheni, which theoretically should not create a problem with zeya. So please hold off. Please, let's try to remind me, hopefully this week, to do a little more research about spouts, to speak to the rabbanim, to clarify the issue with hot water urns and spouts. That was last week. We also finished off talking about the concerns we have if you buy a green salad, a vegetable salad with onions, radishes, scallions. Those, of course, are 100% problematic, because if there was ever time that the knife was used to cut hot tarfas, which could have been any time over the past 10 years of the knife's history, so that flavor, that not kosher flavor, is stored in the walls of the knife. As we cut something sharp, what's known as davar charif, when you have davar charif combined with what the Shulchan Aruch calls duchka de sakina, the pressure, the dochak of a sakin, those two things together, pressure plus sharpness of the food, absorb flavor. And therefore, the onion, scallion, radish will absorb the flavor of the not kosher knife, and that, of course, will make that onion, scallion, radish not kosher. But let's not talk about those things. Let's talk about greens. Let's talk about lettuce, baby lettuce, all those different colored lettuce, and medleys, and romaine lettuces. And, of course, here the fun topic is insects. So let's talk about, for about, let's say, 10 minutes or so, maybe give or take 10, 12 minutes about insects and what we do about them. Do we assume that they're a problem? Do we not assume that they're a problem? Let's just put one thing on the table. Whenever we talk, first of all, insects, the Torah says, are prohibited to eat. Insects are also mida araisa. And in fact, I'll tell you a story without saying the person's name. So as it's a name that many of you are familiar with. A certain Rebbe of mine was once giving a shiur during the summer, and as he was giving a shiur, a gnat flew into his mouth while he was giving a shiur. So after he finished coughing and realized that he had swallowed it, the first thing that he said after his face resumed, you know, normal color, was that 4 lavin or 5 lavin? Because bugs have a unique characteristic of being able to be with one little tiny animal, even though it's less than a kazayas, of violating numerous lavin, numerous isurim d'oraisa. The reason for that is because the pasuk says, do not eat a creepy crawly. Do not eat a flying insect. Do not eat a swimming insect. So what happens if you eat a creepy crawly flying swimming insect? Those are 3 isurim d'oraisa right there. And because they are significant as a complete organism, they will be asur d'oraisa even though it's less than a kezias. Despite the fact that all isurim d'oraisa relating to achila, whenever the Torah says, do not eat this, or the inverse, whenever the Torah says, I want you to eat this, I want you to eat matzah, I want you to eat maror, that always, achila in the Torah, eating in the Torah always means a kezias, which we assume is about the size of the plastic shot glasses. So I assume this is about 3 kezias. This is probably 3 ounces, 3.5 ounces, so about a third of this cup that I'm holding in my hand would be a kezias. When it comes to an insect, an issur d'oraisa would be violated even with a tiny, tiny insect like a gnat. Could be 4, 5, even up to 6, the Gemara Makos writes, up to 6 issurim d'oraisa can be violated with the consumption of one single eatsy beansy spider. Now, the problem that we have with insects more than any other tray food is the fact that there's no bittul. What do I mean by that? Whenever anything not kosher falls on something kosher, we always assume that, let's assume a little bit of milk falls into my challenge. I told you a story last week about my grandmother, but let's say a little bit of milk falls into your challenge. That big challenge is 60 times the amount of milk. Challenge is kosher. Let's say a little bit what's that grease that's made out of pork? Lard. A little bit of lard falls onto my falls into my batter as I'm cooking some kind of baked goods. So that batter will be 60 times the bit of lard that comes in. The baked good is kosher. However, when it comes to bugs do not get batel. That means if I have a bug that goes into my food or that's on my food, even if I have not just rove against it, but even if I have 60 times the size of that bug, the entire item in its entirety, all of it is still prohibited to eat. The reason for that is bittul does not apply on things that are important. How can I make something null and void? How can I be mivatel something? By declaring it meaningless. It's so insignificant quantitatively when I have 60 times its... When I have 60 times heter compared to the iser, the prohibition, so quantitatively it's insignificant, so it's going to be mut, the whole food will be mutter. But what happens if there's something that even though quantitatively it's insignificant, but qualitatively it retains its significance? How could something, even though it's just a tiny bit, be significant qualitatively? Like I mentioned before, if it's an entire organism, that makes it qualitatively significant. And it cannot be batel. So if, for example, you have, you know the joke with the apple, what's worse than eating an apple and finding a worm inside? Eating an apple and finding half a worm inside. So that's true when it comes to, you know, seventh grader jokes, but that's not true in halacha. A half a worm could be batel. So I'd rather have a half a worm in my soup. Don't give me that look. I'd rather have half a worm in my soup because that's not a complete organism. It doesn't have that qualitative chashivas, and therefore it could be batel. If I have a whole worm or a whole bug or a whole something or other in my soup, so then it can never be batel. So let's say I have this, you know, maybe some of you went to camp and you worked in the kitchen and you saw these gigantic vats. One bug falls in that vat. That theoretically could be a question of throwing out the entire vat of soup. But we'll have to, there might be some other issues. Of course, what happens, the famous, you know, story with the guy, the waiter, and the waiter in the restaurant, and the patron says, Mr. Waiter, there's a bug in my soup. I don't remember what he answers, but halachically, what do you do if there's a bug in your soup? Well, you can't leave it there. You have to take it out. Once you take it out, you're fine. Because the flavor that the bug gives off into the soup is a bad flavor. It's not going to, you know, enrich your soup such that you're enjoying the delicious flavor of not kosher food, but the bug has to be removed. What happens if I have a big pot, a big bowl of soup and a small bug? Doesn't matter. You still have to remove the bug. I'm sure you'd all remove the bug, or maybe not even the soup, but yes, the bug does have to be removed. Okay, so the first problem with bugs is that since what in halacha we call it a beria, a bria, a beria, bet, resh, yud, hey, a complete organism not subject to bitul. The second problem with bugs, with insects, that they can't be batel, is when could you have bitul? When could you have things, you know, overpowering or outnumbering the other? When I have something that's defined as a mixture. A mixture is I have different parts, and I can't identify which is which. That's called a mixture. So we assume the heter will outweigh the iser. The permitted food will outweigh the prohibited food. But when it comes to bugs, they usually are recognizable. So therefore, I don't have a tarovet. I don't have a mixture in the first place. And if you don't have a mixture, you can't have the bitul. Meaning only in a mixture, when things are mixed up, I could say the less important are knocked out by the more important. But if they're not mixed up, because each one is identifiable, you can't say something will knock out the other if they're not part of one mixture. There is an Aruch HaShulchan who has some kulas when it comes to berries, when it comes to full insects, and we don't really rely on him, but I'll just tell you what his thoughts are. The Aruch HaShulchan says that if you have a beria that's knocked off, not just by rove, not just by 60 times its size, but by 960, I'm not sure where he got that number from, but if 960 times the volume of that bug would be out, you know, balanced versus the bug, then bitul would happen. That's one kula of the Aruch HaShulchan. And if you look at your classical salad that you're eating, so chances are there are not too many bugs in it, and if they are, they're relatively small because you probably didn't notice it, because if you would notice it, then even if you weren't learning the halacha, you probably wouldn't be eating the salad. Chances are your green salad is 960 times the size of that bug. So we wouldn't be worried about you eating that bug, according to this Aruch HaShulchan. But again, we don't really rely on it, but just one other thought that the Aruch HaShulchan throws out there, which again we don't really rely on, is that the rules of things that are disgusting are a little bit different when it comes to bitul. And the Aruch HaShulchan suggests, again we don't follow it, but maybe things that are disgusting like shratzim won't... I'm sorry, let me take a step back. We said 3 minutes ago, why is an organism chash? Why is an organism not be able to be batel? Because even though quantitatively I overwhelmed it with 60 times its size, but it had a qualitative chashivas. Qualitatively it was important. But if something is disgusting, like a bug, could I say that it's qualitatively important? The whole reason why I can't be mevatelit is because there's something significant about it. It's a whole creature, it's a whole organism. But if it's a disgusting whole creature, whole organism, the fact that it's disgusting takes away that qualitative edge that it has, that advantage that it has, and is going to tell me that I could allow bitul to happen to it, because you're telling me it's important, it can't be batel, it's not important, it's disgusting. Those are two thoughts that the Aruch HaShulchan, two kulas, that he suggests, but we don't rely on those. Before we get into the details, one clarification, and that's not going to be a joke, as you'll see in a minute. Microscopic bugs are not usr. Anything that you can't see without the aid of further clarification, anything that you can't see with the naked eye is not going to be usr. So when you hear about people talk about the New York City water, the copepods, if I pronounce that correctly, no one's saying that, oh, they're invisible and the rabbis are saying it's problematic anyway. No. They're only talking about those copepods that are visible, which might be the case, might not be. That's not today's discussion. So microscopic issues, microscopic bugs we're not talking about. Those are mutter. The Torah didn't prohibit those. We're only talking about things that are visible. Let's talk about different. How dirty could a vegetable be? For example, if you buy vegetables and you see bugs crawling on it, you probably wouldn't eat it. So it's in your best interest not to buy vegetables that have bugs on them. If it's in your best interest, guess whose else best interest it is not to have bugs on their vegetables? The grocers, and more importantly than the grocers, the growers and the producers. So we have to figure out how many, let's call it PPM, parts per million, parts per thousand, parts per hundred, how many units of bugs is there compared to the whole amount of vegetable that we're dealing with that causes problems? Well, let's take a trip to Hilchas Shechita. In Hilchas Shechita, we find something very unusual. The Torah says that you're not allowed to eat something that's treifa, treif. Now, treif is the biggest misunderstanding linguistically when it comes to knowing what the Torah says. When you say something is treif, what does that mean? It does not mean that it's not kosher. Treif is one of a very, very, very specific case. Actually, there are a lot of the cases, but it's a very specific definition. Treif means an animal that's a kosher animal that had a kosher shechita, but had an illness in it that would not allow it to live 12 months. That's what the word treifa means. When the Torah says, neveilau treifa lo tochelu, something like that, that means any animal, even if it's a cow, any animal, even if it's a cow that had a proper shechita, if it had something in its body that will prevent it from living for 12 months, then you can't eat this animal. Now, the Gemara gives a list. There's a parak called Elu Treifos, which gives a list, and I don't know the number. It could be 50, it could be 100, it could be 150. Different kinds of things that could happen inside the body of an animal that could cause it not to live. For example, the most common one is a hole in the lungs. You've heard of glot. Glot kosher. Glot means smooth. The lungs are smooth. It doesn't have the lesions on top of the lungs, because a lesion probably indicates that something was underneath that you need a scar tissue to go on top of to sort of cover over. So if you see a lesion, a bump on top of the lung, that means there's something underneath that scar tissue, and then that's what we're worried about. The halacha regarding shechita is the following. All the different concerns, maybe this internal organ was injured, maybe that internal organ was injured, maybe there was an internal hemorrhage in the brain, I don't have to be worried about. When I do a shechita on a cow, cow's kosher, shechita is kosher, I don't have to be concerned that maybe there was a hemorrhage in the brain 4 weeks ago on this little cow that's dead anyway. I don't have to be concerned that maybe there was some kind of spleen injury or appendicitis or whatever else might have happened in the cow that's not visible to my eyes. If I see something's wrong, okay, so I'm not going to eat it. But I don't have to assume that there's a problem there. Why don't I have to assume that there's a problem there? Because it's amiut she'eno matsui. Those three words are going to be the key words for the rest of today. Miut, a minority, she'eno matsui, that is not common. A low frequency chance of something being wrong, the Torah does not require me to be worried about. Which part of the animal is there a problem with some level of frequency? With the lungs. That's why when I shecht an animal, I've never shecht an animal. That's why when somebody shechts an animal, they will check only one thing in that animal. They will check the lungs. Why? To make sure that it's not a treifa, to make sure that there is no sickness in the lungs or hole in the lungs that indicates a sickness. Because treifas in the lungs are something that are somewhat common. We'll have to get a number for that somewhat. Somewhat common. Common enough that I have to be worried about it. That Torah requires me to be worried about it. And therefore, I can't eat my meat until I know that the lungs were checked. The other things which would, all the other things in the brain, in the spleen, in the abdomen, in the stomachs, in the livers, in the heart, that could be making this animal a treifa, I don't have to be worried about. Why not? Because it's not common. Does that mean that there's nothing wrong? Does that mean that the brain didn't have a hemorrhage a few weeks ago, or that the heart doesn't have some other heart problem that would render it treifa? No, it just means I'm not obligated to check. Maybe it's not kosher. But you know what? The Torah says you could go ahead and eat it because you're not obligated to check. You could assume. The Torah allows you to live it with an assumption that things that are very uncommon, you don't have to be worried about. Now, let's take that from Hilchos Shechita and apply it to Hilchos vegetable salads. In vegetable salads, there are different kinds of vegetables. Or let's say like this. If you're a vegetable grower, you're a lettuce grower, you have different possibilities of growing your lettuce. You could grow lettuce with a lot of bugs, with little bugs, or barely any bugs. So you would hopefully grow the lettuce that has barely any bugs, unless you want to advertise high protein. But barring the high protein, you want to have little bugs. So now, if your lettuce, let's assume we have a few heads of lettuce with us in front of us, and 51% of the lettuce heads have a bug in there, or 51% of the lettuce leaves, if I look at them, would have a bug, that would be asur d'oraisa to eat until I check and verify that this specific lettuce, either piece or this head, doesn't have any bugs there. Yes. We're only talking about bugs that you can see. Yes. Thank you. Let's say I don't have 51%. I only have, let's say, 40%. 40% of the heads that I check are infested, or 40% of the leaves have a bug. So now, from the Torah's perspective, the majority of the leaves are clean. So from the Torah's perspective, I am permitted to eat all of these all of these lettuce heads, even though 40% of them might be infested. The rabbis don't like that so much. Come Rabbanan say that it's not enough just to have less than rov. Even if there is a miut, a minority less than rov, you're still not allowed to eat those lettuce heads or those lettuce stalks, those lettuce leaves, until you check. But they say that's only if the quantity of infested heads or leaves is a miut hamatzui, a commonly found minority. If it's a miut she'eino matzui, it's something that's not commonly found, and again, we'll get to the numbers in a moment, then you don't have to check these lettuce leaves at all. Just like we said by shechita, the shochet does not have to check the brain and the liver and the spleen and the stomachs, because even though something might be wrong there and might render the animal a treifa, we're not worried because it's not something that I have to be concerned about because it's such a low frequency of occurrence. So too with heads of lettuce or with stalks of lettuce, if the amount of infestation per head or per stalk is less than whatever the number is, which we'll talk about in a minute, such that it's a miut she'eino matsui, a minority that is not common, that is not really regular, that is not found, I am not obligated to check those lettuce leaves. So therefore, the goal of every halachic or kashrus agency when it comes to lettuce is to get the lettuce to a level that is in this last bottom halachic consideration. To get this lettuce head into a halachic box called a miut she'eino matzui. That means it has to be that if I check these lettuce heads, there'll be a very small minority, not a common minority, but a very uncommon minority of heads that will have lettuce. That doesn't mean that there's no, when you get a bag of lettuce, when you get that has a hashgacha, when you get a, you know, Gush Katif of Hashalom's lettuce, if you get one of these, anything else that has a hashgacha, that does not mean it's bug-free. It means that the mashgiach has confirmed that there is few enough bugs in the batch that you don't halachically have to check the batch. Are you eating a bug? A few percent chance that you will be. Are you allowed to eat the bug? Well, I won't tell if you're allowed to eat the bug. I'll tell you're allowed to eat the lettuce without checking. Torah does not obligate you to check that lettuce. Rabbanan do not obligate you to check that lettuce. That lettuce is mutar lechatchila to eat without checking. One way that that kashrus agencies work when it comes to lettuce is that they try to figure out, well, you can just take every head and see if what percentage of them have. Well, let's start like this. Let's talk about how much constitutes miut hamatzli or miut she'eino matzli. How much, percentage-wise, what's the percentage frequency of checking lettuce leaves, that I find a problem or not find a problem, will get me safe enough that I'm allowed to, that I could safely know, that I could safely eat these lettuce bags or these lettuce leaves without checking. So I'm just quoting, I didn't do, you know, primary research on this. I took this from an article in the RJJ Journal by Rabbi Dr. David Shabtai. He's one of the people here in the Kollel in YU who actually had his articles about the copepods in New York City water. But this specific point applies to all areas of halacha whenever you deal with bittul. I just took the sources from him. The common opinion is, I know I've heard it from a Shechter, it's the opinion of the Mishkanos Yaakov that says that 10% is the cutoff point. If fewer than 10% of samples have a bug in them, that is considered a small enough minority that you're allowed to eat those things, that there's less than a 10% chance of finding something wrong with them, even though you don't check it. So what does that mean? That means if I have 100 heads of lettuce, 100, let's say, packages of Gush Katif lettuce or Dole Express bagged lettuces, and I check them all very carefully. I checked every leaf in the whole thing. And I find that 12 of those heads or bags have a bug in them, so I can no longer use that brand unless I check. If, however, I find that only 4, 5, 6, 7% of the bags, 7 out of these 100 bags have a bug in them, I'm allowed to eat all 100 bags. I mean, if I know that there's something wrong here, I can't. But this brand I can eat, since the level of frequency of infestation is lower than 10%. Other numbers, I'll tell you something funny, that Rav Shechter quotes with Soloveitchik's opinion that Miyat HaMatzui, this amount that we have to be concerned with is 14.5%. Where did Rav Soloveitchik get 14.5%? That the Shabtai writes in the footnote in his article, that we mentioned that where's this source of knowing what you have to check and what you don't have to check? We started with Hilchos Shechita. Hilchos Shechita, we said, if there is something on the lungs, that we have to check because that's common. Something that's not in the lungs are not common enough that you have to check. So Soloveitchik somehow determined the incidence of problems with lungs in the cows, you know, in Shechita, you know, I guess 50 years ago when he was involved in kashrus 40 years ago, and he came up with the number that 14.5% of animals have a problem with the lung, and therefore he said, that's the number that you have to be worried about, but less than the actual incidence of problems with lungs is what the Gemara says you don't have to be worried about. So that's how he got that number. But I think the common assumption is 10%. But 10% of what? Meaning, I have 10 heads of lettuce, and I find one head that has one bug, that's going to make all of them prohibited? Or two bugs? Or do I say, I have 10 ounces of salad on my plate, and I have to find, it's only going to be, and if one ounce of salad is infested, you have to sort of figure out how to define your 10% of what? I'll just give you an example. It's going to be, I don't know how to apply it to salads. I'll leave it for the kashrus agencies. But let's talk about those poskim who say that we have to be worried about copepods in the water. Okay? So let's say you have to check your water if there's a 10% frequency of bugs. That means one out of every 10 days of the calendar, a bug comes out of my faucet. That means one out of every 10 times I turn on my faucet, a bug comes out. That's when I have to be concerned. One out of every 10, I don't know, I pay my water bill by the month. So one out of every 10 months, a bug comes out, it's usher. One out of every 10 ounces, one out of every 10 kizayises, one out of every 10 revieses has a bug, that's what makes it usher. How do we have a number of 10%, but 10% of what? So Shechter, at least in that context, I saw in that article again, that Shechter felt that you look at the amount of water a person drinks in one meal. And if you have 10 such quantities, let's say a person drinks 2 cups in a meal. Okay, 2 cups. So if you have 20 cups, and on an average, out of every 20 cups, you will find two of them that have bugs in them, that's called having 10% and being a problem. If you would find that for every 20 cups of water, you'd have less than two cups having a bug in them, that is a mi'at she'eno matzi, minority that's not common enough, and you wouldn't have to check your water. That's in terms of how lettuce works. So, halacha l'maisa, when you buy your bagged lettuce, that's actually, I saw a very fabulous article, maybe that's a shiur for another time, how bagged lettuce works. We're not going to get into it right now. But bagged lettuce is basically the mashgiach's attempt to do whatever they can, process the lettuce with streams of water and with wind and whatever else they could do without ruining the freshness of your lettuce, to knock out the quantity of bugs, again, not to make them non-existent, but to knock them under that bar of 10% or whatever that hashgacha agency holds is the shear, to make it an uncommon minority. After it gets below that threshold, you don't have to be worried about checking. Even though, of course, there's a possibility that if you eat enough of this, you might get a bug. That doesn't make it usser. So if you buy Dole Express, and you, after buying Dole Express for the past, you know, every week, you buy one for Shabbos, and after 22 weeks, you find a bug, you're going to call up Dole and say, you're liars. Or you'll call the, you know, the Star K that gives the hashgacha on those some of those Dole Express bags. You say, Mr. Star K, you're a big fat liar. You told me this is bug-free, and I found a bug. What will they tell you? They will tell you that I never said it's bug-free. I just said that the frequency of bugs is not significant enough to require you to have to check. The Torah allows you to eat this without checking. Both the Torah Midaraisa and Midarabanan allows you to eat this bag of lettuce without checking. Okay. Just so you know. Okay, so halakha l'maisa. Most kashrus agencies therefore suggest that a person should not buy a green lettuce salad in a not kosher restaurant, again, without the scallions, without the radishes. That's of course a problem. But even if it's just vegetables that are prone to infestation, if they weren't checked, or if there wasn't some kind of supervision to make sure you got below the mi'at she'eino matzi threshold. However, you should all know that I spoke to Rabbi Willig, who's the head of the Vad of Riverdale, and Rabbi Willig did feel that whenever you have grade A hearts of lettuce, he feels that those are able to be eaten without checking. And according to Rabbi Willig, perhaps the Vad of Riverdale, one could assume that there is not enough infestation to obligate you to check. But again, most kosher agencies probably would prefer not because of the chance for infestation. Yes. If you buy one bag of lettuce without a hechsher, so according to Rabbi Willig, if it's a grade A bag, I don't know what he says if it's not hearts. I'm not sure if it's only hearts or a regular bag without a hechsher, so you could check it. Well, you have to determine that it has, meaning 10% only works when you have a sample, let's say a box of 20 bags, and you checked all 20 bags, and you found that only two of them, or less than two of them had, then you could be lenient. But you have to first know, meaning, if you don't know what the frequency is, you have to check something that might have bugs, you have to check. If you know that the frequency of bugs, the incidence of bugs, are less than whatever, then you don't have to check. Just so you know, you log on to some, I don't know where, but probably the FDA or the government websites, you will find that every produce, every vegetable has a certain allowance based on federal guidelines of bug prevalence. So if you go to look up, I don't know, frozen broccoli, it will say you could have up to, you know, 42 aphids and 29 thrips per 100 grams of broccoli. And that's perfectly legal and mutter according to federal regulations. According to halacha, it's not. One of those is an issur d'oraisa. Again, if it's treated in a way that you don't have such an incident, that's a different question. But, you know, as far as the growers are concerned, it's impossible to grow bug-free fruits unless you use huge amounts of pesticide. So you have a balance of, you know, the health benefits of organic, which doesn't have pesticides but has more prevalence of bugs, or, you know, and health is important in halacha also, or being more careful about bugs, in which case you can have more pesticide. And this is a balance, you know, not just Jews are concerned with, but growers want to have clean crops, but they also don't want to have too much pesticide. So that's a very hard balance for, you know, everyone to strike. Huh. 100,000%, yes. The number of being 10% is not, that's an objective constant. Every region, every product, every climate, every season. If you have the big region in America where we grow lettuce is the Salinas Valley in California. The lettuce bowl of America, apparently. That's what it's called based on my research. So that area is a great area and for growing lettuce, and certain seasons it's going to have very little vet infestation. Other seasons it will have more. Everything will depend. If you find that the Star K has bags that have dull, you know, the dull bags have a Star K. Some bags don't have a Star K. How come? Don't they give a hashgacha? So I don't know, maybe they're different plants. But oftentimes the mashkiach, the hashgacha, will say, this, the level of infestation that I find during November is a problem. November, we're not giving our hashgacha. Oh, during April, for some reason, I don't know, after the winter, all the bugs died, and now there are no bugs on the animals, nothing's hatching, so the vegetables are clean. We will give our hashgacha during November, during April. So this depends on product, depends on season, depends on climate, depends on where in the country you are, 100%. Yes? So if you're saying, if I know that this, I have a, it depends on how you define the sample. That goes into that question I have to leave to the mashgich, to the hashgacha agencies. But you're saying, I have a head of lettuce, and I know that 10% of these leaves, if I know that 7% of these leaves have bugs, and 93% do not. So am I therefore obligated to check this head? I don't know the answer, but it's hard to imagine that the answer is it's okay. Because I don't know if we'd look at a sample with such small... that goes into something that I didn't really discuss about because I didn't do enough research on, and that is establishing a chazaka. You're asking, what happens if I check a few? This is what a lot of restaurants rely on, against the Rashba, against the Ramo, who brings the Rashba, says this doesn't work. But what many hashgachas do is they say, again, we got a shipment of 10 heads that we're going to use in our restaurant today. Let's check a sample of them. If all of them come out clean, we could assume, based on chazaka says you check three things and all are good, then you're good to go. So let's check three heads. If all three heads from this box of 10, 20, 30 heads of lettuce come out clean, I could assume that the rest of them are okay. That's what many restaurants, hotels do. They don't check every head of lettuce. Better hashgachas might check every head. Other hashgachas will rely on samples. Halach l'maisa, if you buy a head of lettuce and you check three leaves, could you therefore assume that the rest is okay? I'm not confident. I'm not sure. I'd have to do a little more research. Okay, let's finish. Let's put vegetables behind us. Of course, if you want to get your if you want to get your green salad in a not kosher restaurant where there's no checking at all, be aware of those basically two streams in the poskim. Of course, salad dressings are certainly problematic because they're cooked in pots that are not kosher. You don't know what's in them, what kind of oils, what kind of fish oils from possibly not kosher fish, and all kinds of other stuff. Let's talk about sushi. You go to the not kosher restaurant and you buy vegetable sushi, right? We're not going to get into, you know, squid and eel and catfish and whatever other fun sushis there might be available. Let's talk about vegetable sushi. Or what other sushi could we get? Salmon sushi, right? Salmon is kosher, and salmon is identifiable based on the red color that no other fish have. So I'll get salmon sushi. So let's think about what is involved with sushi, and then we'll try to take those one at a time. My sushi has my rice. My sushi has my wasabi on the side. Has soy sauce, of course, because what sushi is without soy sauce? And then we have the nori, that's the green seaweed that wraps it up. Let's talk about those one at a time. First of all, the rice. What problem could you imagine might exist with rice? What? Good. Bishul Akum, yeah. Rice is something that is a food that you would serve at a fancy meal, and therefore, and it cannot be eaten raw, and therefore it is subject to the regular laws of Bishul Akam. Rice that is cooked by a non-Jew is usher to eat, period. Okay, so the rice is the problem. Let's talk about the fish. So I heard, this I didn't see anywhere, but I heard from somebody, not an expert, but he said that he heard a presentation from an expert, and he said that at the presentation, maybe it was an OU presentation, that sometimes restaurants or sushi bars don't always have the right fish that they say they have. They're not going to tell you they don't have it, because on their, you know, fabulous menu they have 12 different kinds of fish, and you're not, they're not, if you order it, they're not going to say, oh, we don't have that, because they don't need to walk somewhere else. They'll just give you some other fish, and you're not going to tell the difference, of course, because no one who's buying sushi actually knows, other than when it's, you know, too obvious. You don't know which fish it is. So sometimes they switch the fish on you. So you'll order salmon, they'll give you some other, well, we said salmon might be, is usually red, other fish aren't. Nowadays, that's not always true. You buy some kind of tilapia, or I don't know what other, what's a white fish that they put in? Tuna, you get tuna, you can get, let's say tuna sushi, is that tuna sushi? Come on, somebody? Yes. Tuna, okay, thank you. Right. Okay, so either way, they might switch it on you without realizing. Second of all, this I saw in some, there's a fabulous article put out by the CRC, the Chicago Rabbinical Council, I think, somebody by the name of, I don't remember if it was Rabbi Fishbane or Rabbi Blech, or Blech, I think one of those two, had a fabulous article about sushi in restaurants, which I took most of these marmakomas from. Apparently, some sushi bars, you want to have fresh fish, right? But fresh fish means you have to get new fish every day. That's not always economical or easy, but you still want to say that you're serving fresh fish. So some sushi bars put their fish in some kind of brine that keeps its color very crisp and keeps it very moist or something. It doesn't let the smell go out. And it looks fresh, and they'll tell you it's fresh, but really it could be from yesterday, 2 days ago. And I assume it's refrigerated, so you don't have to be worried about health issues, I hope. But that brine is something that we mentioned in the past. Soaking foods could help absorb flavor. We said usually flavor of not kosher is only absorbed through heat, but soaking is one of the other ways that non-kosher flavor is absorbed. So let's say you have the kosher fish that you ordered, or the kosher avocado or cucumber or carrot or sweet potato, whatever else is going in your sushi. The brine that is, whatever you're ordering might be touching, could make not kosher flavors go in to your fish or to your food. Wasabi apparently is really a farce. Real wasabi apparently is very, very rare and expensive, and they don't really serve that anywhere that you'll go. No offense to any of you. Wasabi, do you serve wasabi? You have the real thing?
For Pesach, my
brother
got it for
tomorrow. Okay, interesting. Wasabi nowadays is horseradish, mustard, and green food coloring. So green food coloring, I don't know, that might need hashgacha. Horseradish, we talked a little bit this earlier today, and last time, duchka de sakina and a davar charif, whenever you grate horseradish, grating is like the pressure of a knife, and horseradish is certainly something that's sharp. You have to be worried about kashrus issues because of the sharpness. Next, soy sauce, even if soy sauce itself might not be problematic, but the manufacturers of soy sauce also manufacture other sauces that definitely could have not kosher ingredients on the same in the same pots, on the same manufacturing lines. There is heat there to transfer flavors. That's a problem. Let's talk about the seaweed paper, the nori. Apparently, it is very healthy. It's very high in calcium and iron, and that's not because of the. The calcium and iron is not because of the seahorses and shrimp that are often dried together with the seaweed, just so you know. It's that this seaweed is like an algae, and algae is very, rich in calcium and iron. So what are the problems with nori? I hinted to one. First of all, some companies apparently flavor their seaweed stuff with shrimp flavors and other delectable flavors, which are not so kosher. However, those kinds of nori, those kinds of seaweed papers, are usually not the kinds that we wrap sushi in. The sushi that we wrap in are usually unflavored, so we don't have to worry about flavors. And they usually have different production lines because they want to be untainted. The Japanese are very meticulous people. The problem with these seaweed papers, the ones that don't have hashgachas, is that they are frequently infested with bugs, because when they smush them, I guess they collect all this algae, the seaweed, and they just smush it and dry it. So as they smush and dry it, whatever is there is there. And among things that are there are what grows with algae, apparently seahorses and shrimp, apparently. Maybe other things also. However, the seaweed paper that we use for sushi is roasted, and somehow the fact that it's roasted, this article said, that somehow solves a problem for bugs. I'm not sure why. Maybe because it makes them break apart, and once they're broken apart, as I said before, there could be bittul applied to them. I know this sounds very, like, not tasty, but if it's a whole bug, it's a problem. If it's a small bug, it's fine as long as you have bittul. If you could be mevatel, it's 60 to 1. So that might be why, he didn't say why the fact that they're toasted solves the problem, but that's what I'm thinking. There are apparently some fresh, that's for toasted paper, seaweed paper, nori, but there are some places, the fancy places have fresh seaweed paper that are not toasted. Those are more problematic, so if you, either way, we're not going to a Nakush restaurant for sushi after this. Apparently, there are sushi papers that have hashgacha. The way they have hashgacha in terms of the bugs is, based on this article, that the companies have some kind of laser detection. Fascinating. They use lasers to figure out the level of infestation. And if a hashgacha is giving a hashgacha on a certain seaweed paper plant, they could know the level of infestation. If the level of infestation is small enough, they will give their hashgacha. If the lasers detect that there's a higher level of infestation than is halakhically appropriate, then the hashgacha will not give the hashgacha on that batch. So, therefore, you should try, if you do make your own sushi, as some of us do, you should try to get seaweed that has a reliable hechsher. He concludes his article, if it's not possible, you could get seaweed paper that does not have a hashgacha, as long as you check carefully between each sheet to see that it is free of any stuff that might be a bug. Finally, the last point that we'll talk about of problems with sushi in a not kosher restaurant is that sometimes when the chefs, one of the most exciting things of going to sushi bars is not just eating it, but is watching the chefs make the sushi. I haven't watched, but apparently he points out that some chefs, as they do it, in order to roll the rice more easily, they dip their hands into something to moisten them. Sometimes they dip their hands into an oil. Oils could be from anywhere. It could be fish oils from not kosher fish. Oils always need hashgachas. You don't know what oil he's using. That's another issue. So, halach l'maisa, we will not order sushi in a not kosher restaurant, even if it is vegetable sushi. Certainly if it is salmon sushi, we won't order sushi in a not kosher restaurant. What about, so we've finished that section. Let's finish with one more main discussion for a few minutes. What about smoked lox? You go to, let's say, a milchika place, and fruit salad doesn't tickle your fancy. Vegetable salad you're a little nervous about. And you figure smoked lox is something that's, right, it's smoked, so it's not cooked, so there's no problem of bishul akum, no problem of using, you know, heat that should transfer not kosher flavors to it. Lox, salmon has a unique red color that only salmon has and no other fish has, apparently until the past few years, where we started breeding our own fish. And based on diets that they serve the fish, if you have a red diet for the fish, then you have white, trout, which is just a white fish. If you serve it a red diet, then it will end up being red trout, and it sells better, so they do it. I had a friend in yeshiva once, I shouldn't be laughing, but he was on a very unusual diet. He was very into weird diets. Not just like general health kinds of things, and he was on this like carrot diet. And for lunch every day, he would have carrot shakes, but like every day. Maybe it was lunch, breakfast, lunch, and supper also. He would take carrots, put them in a blender, and that would be lunch. Believe it or not, he started looking orange. I'm totally serious. I mean, I tell this to my kids, they start laughing. But he really, you know, after, I don't know if this is a few months, but he, a friend of mine in Yeshiva, I saw him every day, he looked a little bit orange. His skin was just a little, you know, the pigment just. So they do the same thing for fish, so we could buy red trout, even though trout's white. But until that time, until recently, that white fish started turning red, it was assumed that whenever you get red or that orangish, you know what salmon looks like, lox colored, that pink sort of pink reddish orange color, that you were theoretically able to buy, even without the skins and fins and scales, which you always have to check a fish for, because you could assume that it only salmon has this color. Nowadays, again, we don't have that benefit. Okay, but anyway, you're going to your milfika. I don't think they have milfiks of flesh this day. You're going to a restaurant and they have lox or smoked salmon. What could be wrong? It's smoked, so there's no heat. It's salmon, so you're good with that. Well, here, is there a Bishel Akum problem? Why not? It's not cooked, 100%. Bishel Akum, the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredea, Kuf Yud Gimel, says that only cooked foods, but not smoked foods, are subject to Bishel Akum problems, food that are cooked by a goy problems. The problem is that when we say smoked salmon, it's actually a big fat lie. And smoked salmon is not just smoked. Smoked salmon is baked, which is subject to Bishel Akum. At the end of the baking, they put a little smoke on it to give it some flavor. So when you're eating lox, you're not really eating raw fish. When you're eating sushi, you're eating raw fish. When you're eating lox, you're not eating raw fish. You're eating fish that was baked. And at the end of the baking cycle, maybe they don't bake it as much, they bake it a little less. At the end of the baking cycle, they put some kind of smoking process that gives it the unique lox flavor. And since it did go through this baking, it is subject to Bishel Akum, and therefore, lox without a hashgacha is prohibited because of Bishel Akum problems. Aside from the fact that now we realize there is heat involved, there could be, depending on the trays that they put it on, and depending on by the oven that they're using, transference of taste from not kosher foods. Let's finish off in the next minute and a half with soda. For here, it's always nice to end on a cool with a kula. Basically, all sodas are okay, not just sodas from cans and bottles, but apparently, again, a CRC article on the cost of sodas points out that all syrups, sodas made out of carbonated water, seltzer, and a syrup, all syrups in America, not all syrups, but the three main manufacturers of syrup in the United States of America are Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, and Dr. Pepper / 7-Up, while Coca-Cola is under the OU. Pepsi-Cola was for the longest time under our own Rabbi Zvulun Chalap, the dean of Ritz, until a year or two ago. I'm not sure if he's still in charge or he gave it over to somebody else. And Dr. Pepper, 7-Up, is under the Chicago Rabbinical Council. Those are the main manufacturers of flavors in the United States of America. So if you know that you're getting Coke, or any of the Coke brands, any of the Pepsi brands, any of the 7-Up Dr. Pepper brands, then you're good to go. And you don't have, apparently it also mentions that article that the way they bottle carbonated sodas is without any heat. There's no heat involved in the bottling process. So therefore we're not worried about any transfer of taste from anything that might have not been kosher on a previous run, because there's no heat to transfer flavor. And whatever residue, I'm sure they wash out because they don't want to mix flavors, so we're not worried about any absorbed flavor, any bleos, because it's a cold process. That's not the case when it comes to sports drinks, juices, ciders, and all the other drinks where there are sometimes heat used in the bottling, but at least carbonated beverages do not have heat in its production. So therefore, halacha l'maisa, if you go to any restaurant, 7-Eleven, even if it's not from a bottle or from a can, you're getting from a fountain, if you're getting Coca-Cola brand, Pepsi brand, Dr. Pepper, 7-Up brand, you are good to go, even, and you don't have to worry about the fact that it's not in a bottle, if it's coming from a spout. Yes? Oh, lemon. So lemon will probably have the halacha of lemons. Lemons, we learned, so the halacha of lemons is that we could assume that when they slice a lot of lemons, even if the knife was dirty, even though lemon is charif, they slice, the chances are the dirt on the knife, the residue on the knife got sliced off with the first few lemon slices. Those first few usher lemon slices get mixed up in the whole batch of lemon slices, and it theoretically should be okay. Even though it's charif, yes.
Okay.
Yes, the Gemara, the Shulchan Aruch speaks specifically about limonish, which is talking about lemons. Now, just picture in your mind's eye for a second, when you have the lemons that at the bar, right? You go to a wedding, there's a bar, and there's lemons. Let's say they're all, you sort of see the shape of the lemon. They sliced it, they cut a lemon in half, and they just sliced it on the plate. So you see where's the middle, where's the end. That could be more of a problem, because how could you say that the bad pieces got mixed up with the good pieces? Well, I don't know. I assume they started with the end. So the end pieces should be more problematic. What? The wedges are probably better because you don't know where each wedge is from. But I'm talking about when you see like a half a lemon, an upside down lemon, flat on its belly. If you assume that it did more than one lemon, then it should be okay. Yeah. I didn't confirm that with any halacha ma'aseh, but based on the Shulchan Aruch, it sounds like it ought to be okay. But it's better to ask without a lemon. Very good. Have a wonderful evening. Any other questions, you're welcome to come over now.